Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
He is going to be locked up for a very long time. Today, the man who admitted to killing a teenager over a pair of Air Jordans learned his fate in court. And it tops our news at 5:30. The judge told 20-year-old Dante Ford that he lacked a moral compass just before sentencing to 28 to 50 years in prison.
Ford pleaded guilty to second-degree murder in the shooting death of 17-year-old Corey Harris Thomas back in June during what was supposed to be a sale of a pair of Air Jordans. Priya Mann following the story. Priya, the victim's parents were in the courtroom, I understand.
And Karen spoke at length. Corey's parents spoke about everything they did to try to prevent their son from living this lifestyle of making a quick buck. He was enrolled in a lot of sports. He went to school in the Grosse Pointe area. But in the end, he lost his life over a pair of expensive gym shoes.
It's not a day I wish I couldn't hold them and tell them I love them.
The parents of Corey Harris Thomas spoke about their devastating loss.
And not being able to open the door and tell him to get up. So he can go to school. It breaks my heart.
But that was my first one. We did a lot together.
In June, the 17-year-old was shot and killed on the west side over a pair of Air Jordans. Prosecutors say 20-year-old Dante Tyrell Ford met up with the teen and his friend to buy the shoes. During the exchange, the friend and Ford pulled out weapons, and the teen was killed.
Mr. Ford took the life of someone almost the same age, and over what? A pair of Air Jordan Nikes.
Ford declined to speak at his sentencing. The victim's parents say they tried everything to prevent their son from being a victim of violence.
I thought that taking him into a suburb would avoid a situation like this because it happened to so many young men.
And Mr. Ford knew that what he was doing was wrong. He had no right at gunpoint to rob and then eventually kill someone over a pair of gym shoes.
And Ford will spend 28 to 50 years in prison. Corey's parents say they really regret allowing him to stay home from school that day. They were having a new air conditioning unit installed. Corey offered to help his dad put that air conditioning unit in their home. He would later go for this ride with his friend and Ford and never made it home. Reporting live from Frank Murphy Hall of Justice, I'm Priya Mann, Local 4.
Such a very sad story. All right, thank you, Priya.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to the channel. Welcome back to another video. Today I want to talk about a young man who I follow and I subscribe to his...
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots. And next thing you know, my accountant died, and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, we have a problem. She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years, signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I done signed and I done stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So
like,
you could just see $100,000, $600,000
deducted. So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here. Oh, man. He said, this woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor. Every tax check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. He said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie, Dawson, I said, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for two straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out the Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming. Sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government. Plus, I had to pay my current taxes. I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. Mm. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up, because my wife said, Steve, you finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling, because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven. The radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last try. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
Is the Black Lives Matter movement succeeding in its aim to end racism? And is life now better or worse for black people in Britain?
Let's have a look at some of the results from our Good Morning Britain survey, which has revealed that fewer than half of black people surveyed think the BLM movement has improved the lives of black people in Britain. While 10% say it has made things worse, 46% of black people say the campaign has had no impact on their opportunities in life, while 50% of white people surveyed say the campaign has improved their understanding of the issues affecting the lives of black people in Britain. So, from Birmingham, we are joined this morning by presenter and comedian David Sideman Whiteley, who quit his job at BBC Radio 1 Extra after the use of the N-word in a news broadcast for which the Director General of the BBC subsequently apologised. We're also joined from Manchester by political commentator and writer Dominic Samuels, and from Bedfordshire, we're joined by G. Chirara, former Met police officer and diversity trainer. Very good morning to you all. David Sideman Whiteley, how do you, you have been in the news right at the sort of forefront of the effect of language, particularly racist language, in the last couple of months. How do you feel right now about what progress has been made, considering you left your job as a result of something egregious that happened?
I feel very, very positive, but that's just coming from understanding that transition is always a tumultuous thing. Like if you're building a house and you're starting with the foundation, that is dirt and that is digging down. It's not building up. And I feel like what's happening right now, that would even make people suggest that things are worse or haven't changed, is simply because what we're talking about tearing down is a system that has taken over 400 years to build. So it's not going to go down.
My home is not for sale. And if my home isn't safe, nobody's home is safe.
What Jim Salit is talking about is the city of Lakewood, Ohio, taking his house, his home, through eminent domain to make way for a high-priced condo that will pay the city more in taxes than he and his wife Joanne do. And he says he's not going to take it lying down.
It's the close-knit, beautiful neighborhood. It's what America's all about. And I'm going to fight them tooth and nail. I've just begun to fight.
I'm Mike Wallace.
I'm Morley Safer.
I'm Ed Bradley.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl. Those stories and Andy Rooney tonight on 60 Minutes.
Just about everyone knows that under a process called eminent domain, the government can and does seize private property for public use to build a road or a courthouse. But did you know the government can also seize your land for private use if they can prove that doing it will serve what is called the public good? Cities across the country have been using eminent domain to force people off their land so that private developers can build more expensive homes and offices, which will pay more in property taxes than the buildings they are replacing. Under eminent domain, the government buys your property, paying you what is determined to be fair market value. But now, people who don't want to sell their homes at any price just to see their land go to another private owner are fighting back.
The bottom line is this is morally wrong, what they're doing here. This is our home, and we're going to stay here, and I'm going to fight them tooth and nail. I've just begun to fight.
Jim and Joanne Salit are refusing to sell the home they've lived in for 38 years in a quiet neighborhood of single-family houses in Lakewood, Ohio, just outside Cleveland. The city of Lakewood is trying to use eminent domain to force the Salits out to make way for more expensive condominiums. But the Salits are in effect telling the town, hell no, they won't go.
We talked about this when we were dating. I used to point to the houses and say, Joanne, one of these days we're going to have one of these houses. And I meant it. And I worked hard.
What'd you do?
I worked in the pharmaceutical industry. And we worked very hard for this. And paid it off. And we said, oh, we've got it. We paid off our home. I retired. And now we're going to spend the rest of our days here and pass this on to our children.
But Lakewood's mayor, Madeline Kane, has other plans. She wants to tear down the Salit's home, plus 55 homes around it, along with four apartment buildings and more than a dozen businesses, so that private developers can build high-priced condominiums and a high-end shopping mall, and thus raise Lakewood's property tax base.
This is a project.
The mayor told us she sought out a developer for the project because Lakewood's aging tax base has been shrinking, and the city simply needs more money.
This is about Lakewood's future. Lakewood cannot survive without a strengthened tax base. Is it right to consider this a public good? Absolutely.
What you're saying effectively is that the Salit's neighborhood has to be sacrificed for the greater good of the city of Lakewood.
I guess I'm saying that that neighborhood is being asked to, and it's difficult and it's unfortunate that they are being asked to give up their home.
They want this whole area because of the view of the park.
Well, it's a beautiful view.
It is an awesome view. They know it's gorgeous, and they want it. It's that simple.
This whole area is called Scenic Park, but that's the problem. Because it is so scenic, it's a prime place to build upscale condominiums. With great views over the Rocky River, those condos will be a cinch to sell.
But the condos can't go up unless the city can remove the Salits and their neighbors through eminent domain. And to legally invoke eminent domain, the city had to certify that this scenic park area is really, quote, blighted.
We're not blighted. This is an area that we absolutely love. It's a close-knit, beautiful neighborhood. It's what America's all about. And, Mike, you don't know how humiliating this is to have people tell you you live in a blighted area and how degrading this is.
You're the mayor. You know the place. Tell me what is blighted about that area.
The term blighted is a statutory word. It really doesn't have a lot to do with whether or not your home is painted. It is a legal statutory term,
meaning
that is used to describe an area. And the question is whether or not that area can be used for a higher and better use.
What does that mean, a higher and better use? What's higher and better than a home?
The term blight is used to describe whether or not the structures generally in an area meet today's standards.
And it's the city that sets those standards. So Lakewood set a standard for blight that would include most of the homes in the neighborhood. A home could be considered blighted if it doesn't have the following.
3 bedrooms, 2 baths, an attached 2-car garage, and central air. Now, this community is over 100 years old. Who has all those things?
You mean it's blighted if it doesn't have 3 bedrooms?
Those things I just told you. That's the criteria. And it's ridiculous.
You don't have central air?
No, and we don't need it because of the air. We always have a breeze.
Sure.
Right off Lake Erie, the breeze comes right through here all the time. We counted all the attached garages in Lakewood. There's 20 in the whole city.
We counted 20.
And by the way, we got up at a meeting and told the mayor and all 7 council members their houses are blighted according to this criteria.
My understanding is that using the criteria that are in place, more than 90% of the houses in Lakewood could be deemed blighted, including the houses of the mayor and of every one of the city council members. True? Do you have 2 bathrooms?
No.
Blight. 2-car garage?
No.
Blight. Is the garage attached?
No.
Blight. And your lot size is under 5,000 square feet?
Oh, well under.
You've called that area a cute little neighborhood. You didn't call it a cute little blighted neighborhood. I mean, you and I know that it's not a blighted neighborhood.
I would never personally walk that neighborhood and indicate that that neighborhood is not attractive or, I mean, I would never say that.
It's a cute little neighborhood.
It is a cute little neighborhood. You'll get me to say it on the record. It is a cute little neighborhood.
Cute, maybe, but without those new condos, it won't produce enough property taxes to satisfy the mayor and the city council.
That's no excuse for taking my home. My home is not for sale. And if my home isn't safe, nobody's home is safe in the whole country, not only Ohio, but this is rampant all over the country. It's like a plague.
This is a nationwide epidemic. We have documented more than 10,000 instances of government taking property from one person to give it to another in just the last 5 years.
Dana Berliner and Scott Bullock are attorneys at a libertarian nonprofit group called the Institute for Justice, which has filed suit on behalf of the Salites against the city of Lakewood. They claim that taking private property this way is unconstitutional.
It is fundamentally wrong and contrary to the Constitution for the government to take property from one private owner and hand it over to another private owner just because the government thinks that person is going to make more productive use of the land.
Everyone knows that property can be taken for a road, but nobody thinks the property can be taken to give it to their neighbor or the large business down the street for their economic benefit. People are shocked when they hear that this is going on around the country.
And it's not just people's homes that are the targets in these eminent domain cases. The Institute for Justice has also filed suit against the city of Mesa, Arizona, to save Randy Bailey's brake repair shop, the shop he got from his father and hopes someday to pass on to his son. The city of Mesa, citing the need for redevelopment, is trying to force Bailey to relocate to make way for an Ace Hardware store that would look better and pay more taxes.
Redevelopment to me is, work with the existing people there and redevelop.
Right.
Not
You get out, we're bringing this guy in.
Bailey's Brake Service has been on this corner for more than 30 years.
In Mesa, this is the corner, Main Street and Country Club. There's not a better corner in this city.
And business has been pretty good down the years?
Business has been awesome.
Now, what used to be in all of this property? I mean, everything else has disappeared.
The city come in and got immediate possession and started demolishing it, making it dirt.
The city has made dirt out of three restaurants and four businesses that once stood on this five-acre lot.
And it's not just business properties that they're doing this on. You know, they wiped out eight people's homes over here. You know, your home ain't even safe.
Bailey told us his neighbors let the city buy them out, but he's refusing to sell.
I'm standing in their way. I'm their thorn in their side.
The thorn in the side of Ken Linhart, who owns the Ace Hardware store a few blocks away. Linhart wants a much bigger store. He could have negotiated with Bailey, but instead, he convinced the city of Mesa to try to buy Bailey's land through eminent domain and then sell it to him.
The city of Mesa wants to move Mr. Bailey about a block away, and from what I understand, it's going to be a new building, new equipment, moving expenses, and everything set up for him. I don't see how Mr. Bailey's going to get hurt.
You can't replace a business in the same location. This place was built in 1952 as a break-in front-end shop. I don't care where you move into City Mesa, it would never be the same.
So Bailey went to Linhart looking for a way to stay on his corner.
I tried to go to him and see if we couldn't work something out on this, and he told me, no, there ain't room for you there. We're going to let the city just take care of you.
Did you ever sit down and try to negotiate with him?
No, I never did.
Redevelopment seems to me to make obvious good sense, but the right of eminent domain to take one man's private property, Randy Bailey, to give it, in effect, to Ken Linhart for his private property.
It happens all over the country. Practically any town you want to go to, they're redeveloping their town centers.
Right.
Now, are we going to sit in Mesa, Arizona, and have our town center decay? As a citizen of Mesa, I don't want that to happen.
If I'd had a for sale sign out there, it'd been a whole different deal. And for them to come in and tell me how much my property is worth, and for me to get out because they're bringing in somebody else, when I own the land, is unfounded to me. It don't even sound like the United States.
And this isn't happening just in small towns. Right here in New York City, a few blocks away from Times Square, New York State has forced a man to sell land on that corner over there that his family had owned for more than 100 years. And what's going up instead? A courthouse? A school? Nope. The new headquarters of the New York Times.
It seems the world's most prestigious newspaper wants to build a new home on this block. But Stratford Wallace and the block's other property owners did not want to sell. Wallace told us the newspaper never tried to negotiate with him. Instead, the Times teamed up with a major real estate developer, and together they convinced the state to use eminent domain to force Wallace out by declaring the block blighted.
I challenge them. This is not blighted property, nor is this property over here blighted.
But New York State Supreme Court disagreed. The court ruled that the newspaper's new headquarters would eliminate blight, and that even though a private entity, the New York Times, is the main beneficiary, improving the block would benefit the public. New York Times executives would not talk to us about it on camera. Back in Lakewood, Ohio, Jim and Joanne Salid are still waiting for their court decision. Most of their neighbors have agreed to sell if the project goes ahead, but the Salids plus a dozen others are hanging tough.
I thought I bought this place, but I guess I just leased it until the city wants it. That's what makes me very angry. This is my dream home, and I'm going to fight for it.
Now the fight is moving to the ballot box. Lakewood residents opposed to the development have gathered enough signatures to force a citywide referendum on it come November.
Greetings and salutations. I'm Christopher Platt, reporting for Your Black World News with an article from DCist.com. Don't forget to subscribe to this channel and visit theblackbusinessschool.com to learn about financial literacy and how you can grow your business today. A D.C. lawyer has filed a discrimination lawsuit against the city on behalf of three Native Washingtonians and CARE, a community group with over 20 members. The suit claims that the city's housing and urban renewal policies have discriminated against some of the district's longest-standing residents in favor of attracting millennial renters. The suit is seeking more than $1 billion in damages. The complaint points specifically to city policies like the Adrian Fenty administration's Creative Action Agenda and Vincent Gray's Creative Economy Strategy, which are specifically geared towards remaking D.C. as a city for creative workers. According to Aristotle Teresa, the lawyer who filed the suit, the city's successful attempts to attract these kinds of workers have come at the cost of D.C.'s low- and middle-income African-American families, who have been pushed out of the city by skyrocketing housing prices. The city is intentionally trying to lighten black neighborhoods, and the way that they have primarily been doing this is through construction of high-density, luxury buildings that primarily only offer studios and one-bedrooms, the suit reads. Many of D.C.'s policies, like the policies of large cities across the country in the mid-aughts, were based on the work of Richard Florida, an influential urban theorist who wrote the seminal text on the creative class. His 2002 book, The Rise of the Creative Class, describes a specific kind of worker, often young, and working in fields like technology, science, art, and journalism. According to his theory, the key to a successful city economy lies in the hands of these workers, who have very particular ideas about where and how they want to live. Creatives prefer indigenous street-level culture, a teeming blend of cafes and sidewalk musicians and small galleries and bistros, where it's hard to draw the line between performers and spectators, Florida once wrote. According to the complaint, former Mayor Adrian Fenty's administration set about creating such an environment to attract these workers, and the two administrations since have kept it going. Teresa says these policies have been directly discriminatory on the basis of age and source of income, as well as having a disparate impact on the city's African-American communities. D.C. residents' access to rental property is predicated at least in part on membership in an invented discrete class, which directly discriminates on source of income, he writes in the complaint. The suit names several defendants, including the Office of Planning, the Zoning Commission,
okay, today our topic is immigration the new gentrification? Now, we played a 60 Minutes piece where, man, I remember the original, I watched it when it was originally aired. I was back in college, so that, I graduated in 1980, so that's the whole story. But what's happening, what you heard in that audio from back in the 70s still applies today in 2024. Gentrification, and I call any of this activity house hijacking. That's what it is. Just like carjacking, well, your house can be hijacked as well. Not just with squatters, but it can be hijacked through the government, local government. Now, in any event, eminent domain, which that was hijacking through eminent domain, that's just one way. I would say it's not the number one way, but they also do it through property taxes, by increasing your property taxes, and they also can do it by code enforcement. I would say number one, property taxes, that'll move you out, then code enforcement. But the primary way is, and it's not done with any intent, evil intent, when they raise the property taxes, it's modern municipal governments with no race agenda. Modern municipal governments got a payroll to meet every two weeks. In addition to that, they have pensions and benefits, which includes insurance that they have to pay out every month. So the easiest target to get it from are the property owners. And if you can't pay the increase in your property taxes, then, you know, they'll sell the tax certificate, which can lead to you losing a house. That's number one way. No race baiting involved or nothing like that. No conspiracy plans or nothing like that. That's just the way it is. They've got their payroll to meet. They got their local government. They got people at DMV, people at the local courthouse, people at your local government agencies, people at the social services office, those employees. They have to be paid every 2 weeks. Then you got your people who retired. They've got to be paid every month. All right. So what has that got to do? Well, what's that got to do with immigration is the new gentrification? Well, a lot of new immigrants are making the income to pay those higher property taxes. And one of the reasons, how are they doing this? Well, a lot of, well, part of it is the education system. I was talking to somebody at Delmar, actually, this morning. He brought to my attention, and it's right in line with Robert Kiyosaki's very first book, If You Want to Get Rich and Happy. I mean, if you want to be rich and happy, don't go to school. That's with a question mark on the way Kiyosaki wrote the book. Public schooling, even private schools, including your Ivy League schools, that's really all secondary education. As Delmar pointed out, in an Amish community, in many of the Mennonite communities, or let's take a real easy one. Like in a restaurant, where I'm at right now, there are 1, 2, 3, 4 Chinese food restaurants. I'm in the middle of 4 of them. Let's see here. 1, 2, 3. Yeah, 4. I'm in the middle of 4 of them. One's a mile away. One's 2 miles away. Two or 2 miles away. And the furthest one is 2 miles away. Okay, so now when you step into any of those 4 restaurants, you'll see that they're family-based businesses. You'll see at least 3 generations of family members they're taking the orders, they're making the orders, inventory, the whole nine, delivery, everything. And I'm just going to go in my neighborhood right now. I'm doing a visual here. But those, now so the first line of schooling for them is the family business, how it runs and operates. An average Chinese food restaurant averages around $1,100,000 a year. That's a nice little tidy sum for a family-run business. So when they send their kids to public schools or a private school, their second schooling of the day. And after they're finished, from 9 to 3 or whatever, when they go back home, they're going back home to the business, to the family business. Then, once again in my neighborhood, the 7-Eleven, run by Asians as well, from either India or Pakistan, they had 7-Eleven. Or if I go in another direction, there's another convenience store slash which has a gas station. Another Asian family, they have that. So most American families do not have a family-based business. Now, so what we do, when we go to school, including private schools, including colleges and university, that's all secondary. That's all extracurricular to them. So, I mean, you know, by the time their teenagers reach 15, 16, these people can run million-dollar businesses. So going back to the title of today's podcast, is immigration to do gentrification? Well, let's tie this into some maps here. On your computer, phone or whatever you got in front of you, I want you to type in the map of Mexico in 1794. What were the boundaries? Give me a map of Mexico in 1794. All right. Once again, go online, type map of Mexico, 1794. You will see, now, Florida used to be part of Mexico. Let me make this bigger. I want you guys to look at this now. 1794. Now, the United States became the United States July 4, 1776. Florida wasn't a part of the, Florida was part of Mexico. It was not a part of the United States on July 4th, 1776. And apparently it wasn't in 1794 from the map I'm looking at. Let me see if I can make this map bigger on my laptop here. So Mexico has been dramatically gentrified over the decades. And it was gentrified of what we would call here in 2024 by a growing nation of immigrants. All different types of immigrants. Now we have, and you know what? The immigrant gravy train, or soul train, or whatever you want to call it, it still exists, and it's coming into the United States as it has been for over 200 years. The United States isn't even 250 years old yet. Still a very young country. Not the youngest by a long shot, but still compared to other countries, it's young. So, the question today, which is going out to all you guys, 619-768-2945, is immigration the new gentrification? Because you have people coming in from China, Venezuela, Syria, Ukraine, various countries in Central and South America. They're going to come in and they're going to seize opportunities that the locals already here might not see. And that's what happened. I mean, like I said, look at the map of Mexico, 1794. Now, the United States, once again, you know, as it eroded and reshaped Mexico, because Mexico got, as you can see, what Mexico looked at in, like in 1794, Mexico got gentrified by immigrants. However, like, what's that movie, Star Wars movie, The Empire Strikes Back? Empire Striking Back. Empire Striking Back. With help. Okay. Because you got people coming in from, I mean, they're here. Venezuela. They're getting some help from Ukraine. I know of a Ukrainian, I don't know this person personally, but she's been here for less than 2 years, came to the United States from Ukraine, a war-torn country, with her clothes on her back and a toothbrush. That was it. Now she works 7 days a week, and she's got a place to stay. It's a room, but it's, you know, but she's got a place to stay, not homeless. And she just bought a car from an auction because she was able to put together like $3,000, $4,000. And she's been here maybe 18 months, not even 2 years. So no matter what they do, legislation, you know, legislation-wise, and typically legislation never outmaneuvers. So here's the thing about immigrants and immigration: immigrants think outside the box. Most people inside the box don't think outside the box, but immigrators think outside the box because they've been outside the box. So they're able to see things that, like, say, the person who hasn't been outside the box, they just don't see. It's there, but they just don't see it. So the boundaries of the United States might not change. And the boundaries of various cities might not change. But the neighborhoods, they are changing. Anyway, I believe immigration, as it, historically as in right, still right now to this day, immigration is the new gentrification because, like I said, but we now call the United States, what, 60, 70% of it, almost, what, 70, I'd say 70% of what we now call the United States used to be Mexico. That's why I say, look, go on, get on your phone, your laptop, your tablet, desktop, whatever you need to do, type in Map of Mexico, 1794. I'm in Florida, so in 1794, where I'm at right now was considered Mexico. Where I'm at right now is considered Mexico. Where I went to college in Texas, I was considered Mexico, whole state. Louisiana, 1794, was Mexico. California, 1794, was Mexico. Oklahoma, 1794, used to be Mexico. Hold on, wait a minute. Oh, wait, yeah. All right, wait a minute. Thanks. Appreciate it. Anyway, where was I? Okay. So, like I say, take a look at that map. And any thoughts? 619-768-2945. If you have any thoughts on that. And now, the way I'm looking at it, it spells a lot of opportunity. Okay, 619-768-2945. Any thoughts on is immigration a new gentrification?
Welcome to Tony Talk.
Welcome to Tony Talk. Welcome to Tony Talk. How's everybody doing today? This is Antonio Moore coming to you from Tony Talks. Wanted to shoot a brief video giving my take on Jay-Z talking about gentrifying your hood and just tell y'all I don't feel that Jay-Z knows what he's talking about. So you had this recent, show that he did, I believe it was at Webster Hall, and he did this weird kind of little jazz rap. But in some ways, what I see is that Jay-Z has basically decided that he's going to take black super capitalism that came out of hip-hop and rap it in ADOS blackness, and none of that makes sense. When I say ADOS, American Descent, slavery, politics, talking about all of the Black Lives Matter backdrop, the reality of black people pushing forward to talk about like wealth and equality and life. But what you see is that he doesn't have the educational background or the political acumen to understand what's going on. I don't think that somebody who uses the word gentrify in the context that Jay-Z has used it understands that gentrification is a process of pushing black folks out that come from slavery and Jim Crow, replacing them with white folks that are basically cups of capital so that white businesses come in that didn't come in when black people lived there. Come on. I just came from Louisville. Dr. Kevin Cosby, shout out to him, has a mega church and has bought property all around that mega church in Louisville, not too far from the downtown. And literally, they don't have a standing restaurant within 2 to 3 miles of that church because it's black folks that are literally making, I think the median income is like $25,000 for a family or something like that, and the median wealth level is near zero. So what he does not understand, him and Jay-Z, is the positionality of black folks in terms of economics. This is not about being negative. This is about being real about how black folks have been cheated. But how do you expect Jay-Z to know better when he did what he did with Brooklyn? We look at the Brooklyn Nets. They came up with a whole new rule, the NBA. We included it in our report, what we get wrong about closing the racial wealth gap. You can find that on the Duke website. Did it with Sandy Darity, one of the leading economists in the area of intergenerational wealth. And what we found is that there's this new rule called the Jay-Z rule where you can't have 100 NBA owners on one team so that Jay-Z or somebody like him owns less than 1% and is used as a face man. But then you look at dig even deeper, and it was a big old ploy and led to gentrification that pushed black folks out of Brooklyn. It was supposed to bring jobs. Those jobs never came, meaning the stadium, the little basketball arena. But then I think for Jay-Z now to be speaking about gentrification incorrectly, it creates misinformation for a generation of black people. It tells them that you are the reason that you're failing, not capital. It doesn't even give context to the fact that black folks own a mere $200 liquid in Los Angeles, a mere $11 liquid in Miami, a mere $8 liquid in Boston. I'm not guessing, I do data. One of the things that we see is that Jay-Z does not understand you are part of capital now. You don't stand with us, you stand against us. When you look at capital, the bottom 90% now has the same amount of wealth as the top 0.1. The top 0.1. Jay-Z is part of that infrastructure to keep you thinking that you're the reason that your neighborhood is failing. You're not the reason your neighborhood is failing. They created your neighborhood in many cases to fail. Outside bar New York and like Los Angeles, you go to Mississippi and Louisiana and Georgia and all kind of cities. What you see is that black folks' neighborhoods are near the worst areas often. And when they're not, somehow white folks find a way to zone it so that you can't make no money. I'm saying to you, this is not a process of black people misusing their money, not buying property, black people not wanting to be American. This is a creation by America. You had a man in Jay-Z who talked about gentrifying your neighborhood before these people do it. Say it straight and say it full-throated with your chest, bro. Say white people. But see, he can't sell. We'll be right back.
Okay. At least from my point of view, and today's podcast is titled, Is Immigration the New Gentrification? I believe it's the continuation of gentrification that's been happening since 17 whatever, or even back 1510 to now. Now this is just my opinion, nothing to do with race, nothing to do with the white man. Gentrification is caused by capitalism, and I'm a capitalist. Gentrification is caused by capitalism and free enterprise, commerce. That's the number one factor. No, number one and number two. Capitalism and the free enterprise system. That's why that map, like say Mexico was, you know, who was the victim? Who was the victors were the capitalists, and the people who took advantage of the free enterprise system. That's it. Bottom line. That's the way I see it. So, if you are a capitalist, and you participate in the free enterprise system, you and yours will be okay. You and yours will be okay. That's the way I see it. I believe you, just like there's been a lot of talk, or more and more talk progressively over the last 5 years or so about African Americans and reparations. Well, the Mexicans, they can, hey, look what we're like. Hey, look what Mexico used to look like. Okay. They got a huge argument for reparations if you look at that map. But here's where I'm going, because I believe the primary engines of gentrification is capitalism. And once again, I am a capitalist. That's what I am. And I believe most people that listen to this podcast, no matter where you are in the world, you're a capitalist too. Not all, but many. The combination of capitalism and the free enterprise system, okay. Where was I going with this? Well, here's where I'm going. The immigrants that are coming into the country from China, from Venezuela, from Syria, from Ukraine, from, Colombia, Peru, Bolivia, Ecuador, Costa Rica, you name it. The people that are coming through that border, southern border of the United States, some fly in, quite a few fly in legally. They overstay illegally, but I'm just saying. The ones that fly in, the ones who, you know, cross the river, come across the border, whatever way, the ones that head towards the, what do you call those cities, sanctuary cities, those are capitalists. A good portion of the immigrants that have come from all those places I just named, some places I haven't named, Ukraine, Venezuela, China, South, you know, Mexico, Belize, Costa Rica, Colombia, all those immigrants that have crossed the border or want to cross the border, they are capitalist. You ain't getting a bunch of socialists coming over. You're not getting them. You're not getting communists. You're not coming. You're not having people coming in to live off the state. Now, they might do it for a little bit. They get food stamps. But then after they get the Ukrainian that I know about has started her own business legally right here in the United States. Gentrification is caused by capitalists and people who take advantage of the free enterprise system. We have that here. If you're a capitalist and you know how to recognize and or create opportunities within a free enterprise place here in the United States, there are plenty of places where you can do it. Now, for me, I think the rural areas are the easiest places to do something. But in, you know, even in crowded density places, because there's an information, like one of the things I'm setting up are, and I do it with these podcasts, what I call media stations. Social media stations. Social media stations, the way I look at it is, just like with this podcast, podcast support. You know, you're not regulated. You can say what you want to say. And then you're going to put out information that is typically not, that you're not going to hear on the Today Show. The people, that just in my opinion, this is just my opinion. The people, no, if you're looking at it from a race car thing, no, you're missing the boat. You're missing the smart party. All right, it might look like that. Gentrification happens with it's two things, capitalism and the free enterprise system. If you are a capitalist and you can recognize and or create free enterprise opportunities here in the United States, and there's a bunch of them, there is a bunch of them. But they're not teaching this. See, that is where we go to the educational part. Grades 1 through 12 in a public school, grades 1 through 12 in most private schools, grades 1 through 12 in public schools and most private schools, they teach you how to read, write, and count. Now, either way, grades 1 through 12, private school or public school, including Harvard, Yale, and all those places, those are schools that are preparing you in part, well, they're making sure you can read, write, and count so you can apply for a job to work for somebody else to make somebody else's family business or family rich. There are people that go 1 through 12. Did he get a job at Walmart? You're making the Walmart family richer. Now, if you're happy, great. But then, like I say, these are the visible signs. I mean, but you know, you have people that might, they have a family Chinese food business, dry cleaning business, convenience store business, dollar store business, auto brake business. You know, there's a lot of family-based little businesses around on a landscape. What their first school is learning the family business at school. And now with homeschooling, you know, they need not even pop into a Harvard, Yale, or public school or private school. But they don't need a government job. They don't need to get a job with benefits, because they, within their family business, which is a school for them, that's their first school. They go to school twice. First thing, the family business school, they live there. Okay, they live there. Then their kids take 6 hours out the day, and go to their second school, That school that most people attend, you know, public or private school. Then they come back home to their primary school, which is the family. And they run the gas station, the vendors, whatever it might be. But if you're still on that race card stuff, no, you miss going to the smart party. Gentrification, once again, the way I see it is the way I see it is the way it is. That's up for you to decide. But the way I'm looking at the world, gentrification is caused by, and it's not necessarily a bad thing. I'll give an example. My house in D.C., last year I got a new neighbor, and my next door neighbor, all right, my neighbor prior for over 50 years was a black family, Clark family. And then the elder, Mrs. Clark, she lived to be 102 years old, but prior to her transitioning, her two children sold the house for a little bit over $600,000, $615,000, something like that. Sold it within 7 days for $600,000. Who bought it? A Korean family who owns a nail salon. Entrepreneurs. Once again, gentrification, and this is in Washington, D.C., which back in the 70s was considered Chocolate City. It ain't Chocolate City no more. Gentrification, in my opinion, I'm going to say 99%. 99% of gentrification is driven by capitalism and the free enterprise system. 99.9.
Let's keep switching the identity to hide the people. Why don't we just keep renaming you? Are you Negro? Oh, no, you're not Negro. No, you're colored. No, you're not colored. You're African American. And this is what they name you. The slavers name you this. Because I know a white guy who grew up in South Africa, and he now lives in America. He is an African American, and more African American than most. Do you see how African American is a misnomer? It's a misnomer. Don't check that box. It's a title given to blacks by democratic slavers.
Interesting. At one time, and still now, some people use the term Negro, which is or Negro, which is in Spanish. But maybe a more accurate description might be maroon, which is brown in Spanish. It's all political.
And now, an exclusive first look at the upcoming documentary, 7 a.m.
Because true economic science is a branch of military science. War and money go hand in hand. Most wars are fights so people can make more money. And war is money. That means what? That the European American is not about to prepare black children to compete with his children for control of the economic sector. It's not going to happen. So if black people want this science, we got to teach it, we got to study it, and we're going to have to make some mistakes in perfecting it because we're still babies in the water of global economic commerce. As African people, we are financially illiterate. So we should not be surprised that we're so economically backward because we were never taught how to be economically forward. Our education in America has not provided or prepared us to be able to compete with Europeans economically. The historically black college was designed to do what? Teach you how to work for white people. Public schools, charter schools, parochial schools, independent schools. What is the purpose of education in America for black children right now? To teach them how to make a living working for white people. But I don't want the kids coming to my school to be going to class thinking that I'm learning this so I can go and get paid by a white person. they're going to be empowered to start their own business. When they leave that school, they're going to go into business. And why do we need our people to be self-sufficient? Because when you're not self-sufficient, you can't speak your mind. One of the biggest reasons why black people have been so cowardly in the post-civil rights movement, not standing up for ourselves, standing up for our children, standing up against police brutality, we're scared to lose our jobs. We have to work. We got kids. I can't talk about the racism on my job. I might lose it. So the reason why we're not speaking our mind is because we don't have economic freedom. As Mr. Garvey said, Marcus Garvey said, that a solid racial program must be built on a solid economic foundation. Show me your economic condition, and I'll show me your political condition. The political economy of the black community rests on the premise that because they do not make their own money, they are enslaved to Europeans. And as a result of that, they will never be able to do what needs to be done to carve out a future for their children, because the hand that pays is also the hand that rules them.
Okay, today's question is immigration the new gentrification? This is part one, and I'm just throwing out some of my thoughts out there. You're welcome to offer some of your thoughts, including you can throw in reparations as well. And one of the, particularly when it comes to reparations, I told people earlier in the podcast, go online and put into the search engine, get a map, get the 1794 map of Mexico. Or you can get the 1776 map of Mexico too. Because originally the United States was 13 states all on the eastern seaboard. Florida was not one of the original 13. In 1776, July 4th, as well as, you may as well say, July 4th, 1794, Florida, where I'm at right now, was part of Mexico. And on the 1794 map of Mexico I'm looking at right now, I would say of what we now call the continental United States, I would say in 1794, about 70%, it was over 50%, 70%, it looks like about 70% of what we now call the United States. You know what? Yeah, 70% of what we now call the United States was Mexico. Correct me if I'm wrong. Look at a map of Mexico in 1794. Florida was a part of Mexico in 1794. So was the state of Louisiana, Oklahoma, throw in Missouri, Arkansas, Iowa, Colorado, all of California, Arizona, New Mexico, all that was Mexico in 1794. So what happened? That Mexico was gentrified by immigrants. But they just weren't just any old kind of immigrant now. These immigrants is... Now, people can disagree with me on it, because we get a lot of Americans get into this race car politics stuff. The way I'm looking at it, I'm not saying I'm right. This is just my opinion. I'm just one person out of 8 billion on the planet. I'm saying the primary engine of gentrification, that what makes gentrification move, do what it does, is capitalism and free enterprise opportunities, or free enterprise opportunities that the individual sees and can make happen. They're not waiting on government. They're making it happen. I believe those two things right there, capitalism and the free enterprise system. Now, when I say free enterprise system, the way I see it is there's little or no government regulation. Matter of fact, let me throw this out here. There are 8 billion people plus on the planet right now. This is what, February 2024. Okay. February 2024, there are 8 billion people and counting on the planet. And there's around, look it up on your own. I believe there's in the neighborhood of, let me look it up. Hey, man, we got these calculators here. Okay, number of billionaires on the planet. Okay, how many billionaires? There are 3,194 billionaires on planet Earth right now, out of 8 billion people. That's not a whole lot. Small club. All right. Now, how did they, minus the people who got an inheritance, because most of the billionaires did not inherit their wealth. They're like first-generation billionaires. How did they do it? Let's go back to what I'm saying, what drives gentrification. Capitalism and free enterprise. Most billionaires, now I'm excluding the ones that inherited their billions. Free enterprise, basically, the best and most pure free enterprise opportunities is just where there's little or no government regulation. There's a lot more government regulation today than it was on July 4th, 1776. In 1776, there was no such thing as a DMV. DNC is a government regulatory agency that sets rules that you just can't do anything you want to do on these roads, on these streets. In 1776, with your horse and buggy and your carriage, you can do what you want to do. There was no social services office in 1776, July 4, 1776. There's a whole lot of local, state, and federal agencies that did not exist on July 4, 1776. And that's why they were calling, hey, man, come over here. You can get wealthy over here, because the countries that people came from the old countries, from the old world, you know, England, Scotland, Ireland, France, you know, European countries, they had rules and regulations because, boy, they're older countries. The United States isn't even 250 years old yet. The United States is still a very young country. All right. However, as each year goes by, it gets more regulated than some of these older countries. Now, matter of fact, let's take a look at Berlin. Oh, let's go to. I've been to Frankfurt, Germany. Okay, I've been to Frankfurt, Germany several times. So let's look like, how old is Frankfurt, Germany? Okay, Frankfurt, Germany. Where's the Wikipedia page on it? Here we go. Okay, Frankfurt, What is the okay, 18 I'm trying to get the all right, wait a minute. I got something. Hold, let me look for another city. Let's go to Asia. Let's go to Kyrgyzstan. Okay. OSH. That's in Kyrgyzstan. Okay. OSH is the second, that's the second largest city. Hold it, wait a minute. I'm trying to get the history of OSH. Age. Okay. OSH in Kyrgyzstan. This is in Central Asia. And OSH is OSH. OSH is ...3,000 years old. Okay. It's 3,000 years old. So let's take 3,000 and what's this, 19, or hold, excuse me. Oh, 2024. OSH in Kyrgyzstan. OSH is a vibrant city, but OSH is 976 years older than the United States. Let's go to and that's why a lot of people come to, I mean, hold on, you got, let's go to China, man. See, I've been to Beijing. So Beijing is what used to be Peking. Let's see. Beijing, let's check out Beijing. Why do you have people from China immigrating? I mean, risk saving up where, I mean, because they get that. It's not cheap to immigrate. They come from a lot of these places. Like I said, I know of a person. She came to this country from Ukraine, a war-torn country, with the clothes on her back and a toothbrush. So why are these people in 2024 doing this? All right, so let's go to China. How old is China? Not China, but very history here. All right, China, let's see. They have caves dating back to 230,000 years ago. Let's see. Homo sapiens, 27,000 years ago. The first walled city of Beijing, which used to be called Peking, the capital city in the state of Zhai, which was built, all right, 1045 B.C. Jesus Christ. Well, the older the city is, particularly if it's a largely densely populated city, which are found in a lot of these older countries, you have more rules and regulations, which means it's just harder for you to gain any type of personal or familial wealth. So over here, let's see, Ponce de Leon, you know, the first European Over here, we count it by that, 15, 10. Matter of fact, let's look at it from this, too. From, 1776 to 1510. All right, 1510, all right. There was a 266-year run. Matter of fact, I'm going to shave a year off of this. From 1776 from 1509 to 1776, there was like a 265-year run where, as in today's parlance, it was completely off the chain in what we now call the continental United States. You didn't need to get a license to build a house. Now, let's get in the mindset of back in the day, back in their day, because we're going back 300-400 years from the Christopher Columbus days and all that, I'm going from 1509, 1510. So Columbus and them, this is after Columbus and all that. Because matter of fact, let's take 1510, that's Ponce de Leon, and 1492. All right, that was an 18-year. So for 18 years after the word got out from the Columbus voyages, okay, I'm going to bring it up to today, and our title today is Immigration, the New Gentrification. When they came over, those 18 years, 1492 to 1510, the word was getting back, man, you can go over to this place. You can drink as much as you want. They got women all day long. You can screw them all day long. You can beat them. You can make them work. You can do anything you want. There's no constable. There's no police. There's no gun. It's off the chain. Whatever kind of way they were using, language they were using back then, the bottom line, that's how it translated. I can go over to this place. Think about it. They had people, the dregs of society, that sailed with Columbus and these other so-called explorers that came over on those ships. Now, these guys became property owners. They didn't have to pay no property. They didn't have to pay nothing to the king or the queen, nothing to the throne. I'm sure some guys, particularly after they came back for a second voyage, they said, I'm not going back. I'm sure there was a lot. I like to find that part of the story. I'm not going back. I got a woman or I got women. I can do what I want to do, including killing. You had some sociopaths back then, just like you got sociopaths now, but no police force, no prison. You know, I got this land for as far as the eye can see. You know, I got kids over here now. I'm not going back to England. I'm not going back to France. I'm not going back to Portugal. I'm not going back. I'm sure there were some people just like that, just like the passport bros do now, and they talk and compare notes. I'm sure for those first 18 years, those people that got those that worked with Columbus and Magellan and all those guys, I'm not going back, man. And they told others, because the whole Western Hemisphere, two continents, North and South America. That's how they got populated, word of mouth. No internet needed. That was the internet. For men and women. People that couldn't get a mate over there, people who were struggling over there can come over here, build a house, build it where they want to build it. They didn't need to get no permit, because there was no government set up like that. There were no government agencies set up like that. So hold it before I get off too much on this rant. What's this got to do with billionaires? Billionaires are made in free enterprise areas. But here are the free enterprise areas. It's free enterprise areas where there's little or zero government. Bill Gates, matter of fact, a better example of Bill Gates. What's his name? Zuckerberg. How did this dude become a billionaire at 24 years old? Well, cyberspace, the World Wide Web, you don't need a business license to get a domain name. Unless they changed the rules yesterday, something I don't know about. The reserve a domain name costs anywhere from $2 to $5 today, 2024. You can be an axe murderer and get a domain name. Because Facebook is nothing but a glorified website. That's it. He didn't have to get a college. Matter of fact, he attended Harvard for 6 months, dropped out. Went for one semester, whatever, wasn't dropped out. School, grades 1 through 12, and college is primarily designed to train you or indoctrinate you into the workforce to work for somebody else's family. Immigrants from day one, not only in 2024, but immigrants, once again, let's look at the map from 1794. Immigrants gentrified Mexico. They call it the United States, but it's basically immigrants. And it will happen. Matter of fact, it's not will happen again. It is happening again. Empire Strikes Back. Because they're going to see opportunities. Because, see, that's what happened from 1492. They saw opportunity. They saw, damn, wait a minute, I can do this here because I can't do this where I just came from. So these people that are risking their lives, that are taking children, you have some people some of these immigrants that have been born in, you know, getting over here. And they're looking for, man, they see the opportunities for free enterprise before they even leave their before they even leave their country of origin and then even travel over here. They already see it. So when they come here, they're, all right, well, let's get going. Now, if you see differently, 619-768-2945, but the way I see it, gentrification is driven by capitalism and free enterprise. You'll start to hear stories about immigrants that have come to these United States. We're going to start hearing millionaire stories in about, I say, 12 to 18 months. In less than 60 months, you'll start hearing immigrant billionaire stories. Because they're going to see within our free enterprise system opportunities where there's little or no government regulation, and they're going to make their fortune. Just as Bill Gates did, Steve Jobs did, Jeff Bezos did. Now, of course, once you go Wall Street, you're regulated. But these guys were worth billions before they went public. And we'll probably follow this on a regular basis. That's what we call today's podcast, is Immigration, the New Gentrification. Matter of fact, is it the new gentrification? Let's just really call it, now that I think about it, immigration is the continued gentrification. Because it's been like that since 1492. Once again, from the way I'm looking at it. But, I'm just one person. We like different points of view, so 619-768-2945. If you have, the thing is, when you have little or no gentrification, I forgot how I got hold of it. The Devil's Punch Bowl, which let me go read that real quick, because this is the downside of a free enterprise system. Although I'm a capitalist, I love capitalists, and I like the free enterprise system, there is a downside to it. So let's go to the Devil's Punch Bowl. Here's the downside of it. The Devil's Punch Bowl, and you can look this up on Wikipedia, because this is Black History Month. The Devil's Punch Bowl. Now, the Devil's Punch Bowl happened in the free enterprise system, because there wasn't a complete checks and balance system in place to prevent this. The Devil's Punch Bowl was a refugee camp created in Natchez, Mississippi during the American Civil War to provide temporary housing and assistance to free slaves. In order to house the numbers of formerly enslaved African Americans. Now, see, this could have gone a couple of ways, but I'm going to read it how it happened. All right. The Union Army created a refugee camp for them at the location known as the Devil's Punch Bowl, a natural pit surrounded by bluffs. Many of the formerly enslaved died of starvation, smallpox, and other diseases. It has been suggested that over 20,000 formerly enslaved people died there in 1 year. However, the scale of the tragedy has been disputed by multiple historians, with history professor John Wiggins arguing the 20,000 estimate is baseless and inflated tenfold. Okay. Now, this probably could not happen today in 2024, but it did happen. We can even probably do a whole podcast on this later. They say the Union Army was involved, which I guess there was a case for reparations. This could be a case for it. Particularly if you can, I had to read more about it. Was it, did they keep records? Who were the 20,000 people or whatever? But I guess I had to do more research on it. But that's the downside, because with a totally free system, where there's no rules or regulations, where, what they call it, when it's off the chain, that chain can swing two ways where there's a lot of negativity. This is an example of it. Okay. Now, let's take another flip of the coin on this, though. Had there been an enterprising, now think about it, had there been an enterprising person that said, man, what, 20,000 people? Let's put together our resources and develop our own town or towns. Let's grow our own food. But there's a whole bunch of things that were going on back then that I'm not aware of. Where because back during this period of time, these people were defenseless. So that's the downside of a total free enterprise system. But we'll have to cover this in more detail later as I get more. And yeah, I want to find out more details on it. But when you get a chance, read up on the Devil's Punch Bowl. All right. But you have a lot of government or quasi-government agencies today that are set up to have rules, and sometimes it works for the betterment, sometimes it doesn't. But when they were talking about America is the land of, there is a lot of opportunity, and there still is a lot of opportunity over here. But you've got to see it, and in some cases, you have to create it. You have to invent it. At least that's my take on it. So, okay, look, we got a few minutes left here today. But take a look at that 1794 map of Mexico. We can do a whole podcast on that. Now, what if Mexico says, hey, we want reparations? Okay. What if they said that? Look at that map. Look at the 1794 map of Mexico. So Mexicans can they want a reparations check or what? Because you do have people, you do have Mexicans that on that bandwagon for that. Italians, you got Italians who were lynched. You have Chinese who are lynched. Can the United States government afford to pay, well, particularly Mexico? I mean, can you look at that map, 1794 map. That will go into the, it will bankrupt the United States. Just saying. But either way, to take advantage of gentrification, you, whoever you are, you can take advantage, because basically gentrification is the, now if maybe somebody in the audience sees it differently, and you can change my mind, 619-768-2945. But I see gentrification basically as driven by capitalism and free enterprise. And I'm basing it heavily of the 1794 map of Mexico. Because on that 1794 map of Mexico, you also have, you got the United States on there. United States, it did exist in 1794. But that map is no reflection of what it looks like today. And how come that Mexico just got gentrified like that? Well, it was by, matter of fact, let's go back to Claude Anderson. Claude really breaks this down. What did immigrants do? See, immigrants saw how they can use government. Because I look at government as a piece of clay, piece of Play-Doh, you can shape and mold it the way you want. So let's listen to Claude Anderson and then apply it to what immigrants did to that 1790, to make that not the 1794 map molded the way they wanted it molded. Immigrants did this.
Listen to me. Rich people think differently. So what I'm going to put in your head today is rich people.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. build your businesses and your industries, control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and it's like, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics.
Now, see, that's what immigrants did. They came over, pilgrims. There are waves of them, as we all know. They were entrepreneurial based. They were capitalists. And they bankrolled politicians who were already in this system. They dictated their agenda from the neighborhood on a local level to the state level to the federal level. Immigrants have been doing this. That's how they shaped the United States of America. People from Scotland, people from Ireland, people from England, France, Spain, Belgium, even Africa. Immigrants were the ones that essentially Claude Anderson is just repeating what they did. They started businesses first. Even black folks that came over as immigrants way back did the same thing.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry and put that pulls in your money and hold that money and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
All right, so that playbook that Claude Anderson laid out, That has been the immigrants' playbook for well over 200 years. Matter of fact, depending on where they came from, because Ocean Kyrgyzstan is over 3,000 years old. So, once again, if we're looking at the map of Mexico in 1794, okay, and a map of Mexico in 1794, and most maps you'll see of that time period, the United States was in existence already. But you'll see, what it grew into, the United States has always been a place for immigrants from day one. And they gentrified Mexico. So the map that we currently have, you know, a lot, like say 60-70% of that map of Mexico, they did it through those steps. Now, of course, they didn't have radio stations. Look, let's look at the two fundamental steps. A, family-based businesses. They established family-based businesses. Parents taught their children entrepreneurship at home. That what was happening educationally-wise in 1794. With that, they were able to establish industries and practice group economics and practice group politics and turn Mexico, or erase year by year, decade by decade, they erase Mexico into what it is today. Now you have immigrants come. The immigration gravy train has never stopped. Once again, I'm erasing colors today. You can black. It doesn't matter if you're black or white or yellow, green, blue, or brown or purple. There's only one color. The color of capitalism. And the color of the free enterprise system. That's it. Those are two colors that gentrification go by. When I played the 60 Minutes piece earlier in today's live stream, every neighborhood or building or whatever, all those were white, all American white folks. They weren't poor ones either. From Wall Street to Ohio. The brake shop guy in Arizona. These were not poor white people, and they got gentrified. So it's not a race thing. Capitalism and free enterprise. We all have, and I was talking to a high school friend, you know, he was talking about equal pay. I said, man, that, to me, it's an outdated thing. Look, there are 24 hours in the day. There are 24 hours a day for me. The same is for you, whoever you are. Same as for Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, the guy with Toyota, Korea Air, which is a family-based business. Now, here's the thing, Skid Row Bun. What are you doing on an individual basis with your 24 hours? Jeff Bezos started Amazon with an idea and 24 hours in a day. Now, we all have ideas, and as long as we're living and breathing, we got 24 hours in the day. Now, the Toyota family, what they do with their 24 hours in the day, they didn't start off with this way, but they do it now. They manufacture 29 cars per minute. That's what they do with their 24 hours. Some other people that are more intelligent than the Toyota family, have a higher IQ than the Toyota family, might use their 24 hours smoked up in a crack pipe. Others might decide, well, I'm going to use my 24 hours to get me two jobs. The common denominator is we all got the 24 hours. It's what we do individually with that 24, what we do individually, because we can decide to go solo or we can get together, because when Toyota gets together with other people, he has formed a Toyota family, because it's still a family business, Toyota. They have a family business where they get the community together and they build cars. So they share the wealth. That's what they do with their 24 hours. Because if I get together, look, I got 24 hours. That's all I got on an individual basis. That's all we all have on an individual basis. However, if I partner up with you, then we got 48 hours within a 24-hour day. Matter of fact, let's go to Toyota here. Okay, Toyota, let's look at the Wikipedia on Toyota. Toyota Wikipedia. Okay, let's see what they have. All right, Toyota. Right, Toyota Motor Corporation. They're 86 years old. Kichiro Toyota was the founder. I remember it started with one. It's still a family business. Then a banking, financing, leasing, and automobile production. Let's see. They got all kind of divisions. I mean, how many employees they got? Okay, Toyota. Let me look at this. Number of employees. And remember, the guy started with one himself. All right, Toyota has 350,000 people globally. So I'm not going to play it today. Nine hands. So he's got 355, let's see, 1,000 times two. Toyota's got 700,000 hands to help him produce the 29 cars per minute. Toyota family, they are capitalist, utilizing the free enterprise system. Now think about it, because I haven't said this in a while, but because I really don't get into the race stuff too much, because I say everybody gets shit on. Japanese Americans were shit on in this country when they were put in concentration camps. Through Ronald Reagan, let me put this in the right context. Through Japanese Americans, through people like Toyota and other Japanese, they, once again, government is like Play-Doh. It's like clay. You can mold it, but you need money to mold it. So they went from being in concentration camps, then they got paid reparations to their political contributions, and now in this country, you have Toyota, you have Kawasaki, you have different Japanese companies all through the United States, particularly automobiles, motorcycles and all that, because, and they, to my knowledge, I haven't seen them march in protest, That's why I play that Claude Anderson piece every single morning. So let me answer my question, because the original question was, is immigration a new gentrification? I got to change that, my thinking on that. Immigration is a continuation of gentrification. Because, like I say, based on that 1794 map, that's how it was done. Immigrants, they came in with new ideas, and they saw opportunity. Because think about it. We're talking about people with limited resources other than the community. And they say, you know what? They don't have one of these here. Let's start up something. I mean, think about it. Chinese food. I eat that once a month. And the Chinese food that we eat in America really isn't real Chinese food. It's more like Chinese Americans, because they saw, you know, this is what Americans like their food. So we got to, you know, tilt it towards the American taste bud. No, I mean, next time you're in a Chinese carryout or restaurant, or particularly carryout, and you go pick up your egg foo young or your sesame chicken or egg rolls, whatever it might be, and you might catch them and look what they're eating and look what you just bought. Now, both are good, but I'm just saying they're eating something that's not on the menu. They're eating real Chinese. You're eating American Chinese. Two different cuisines. But we call it Chinese food. All right, anyway, I done ran my mouth for the day. We'll be back tomorrow. Everybody have a good rest of the day.